Robin Young, it's here and now. The International Red Cross has begun a massive relief effort for the seven countries reeling from the worst earthquake in the world in 40 years. The magnitude 9 quake struck beneath the Indian Ocean off the coast of Sumatra, creating giant tsunamis. We'll have more on the relief efforts, but first, Doug Bailey, a former reporter for the Boston Globe, was with his wife in Penang, Malaysia. And Doug, there's no tsunami warning system in the Indian Ocean, so there was no warning that a wave might be coming?
Well, you know, the tremors were felt here pretty heavily. So some of the hotels had evacuated, but there's nobody thought about the aftershocks and a tsunami of anything of this proportion.
We understand that it was also Boxing Day, a big holiday, and so that the numbers of jet skiers, swimmers, boaters, as you and your wife write, were larger than normal. What did that first wave look like? Was there a sense, could they see it coming? How did that first wave hit?
You know, I didn't see the first wave, but I talked to a lot of people who did. And it's very interesting, you know, we all have this image of a tsunami as this giant wall of water coming toward you. Nobody described it like that. It was more like a tub overflowing. It was suddenly the ocean rose.
Well, and this was about 1 p.m. local time, and 2 hours later, from your writing, there was a second wave that you could see coming?
The second wave that I saw looked more like, you know, what you would picture or saw in the movies, just this wall of massive, you know, flow of water surging toward you, and you just didn't know when it was going to stop.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know how high the wave was. Maybe it was 10 feet, but it felt like 50, you know.
What's happening now, Doug? How are people reacting now?
Well, the thing I'd want to stress the most here is that Malaysia is, you know, is probably the luckiest of all Southeast Asian countries. It hasn't been hit with any of the magnitude that the other Southeast Asian countries have been hit. However, like I said in the story, that's no solace to the people who've lost loved ones, and a lot of the dead are children. You know, I saw a mother who had to be restrained from running back into the ocean trying to find, you know, her children. And the cleanup was going on today, but there's still, I went up to the beach tonight, and there's still people huddled around just talking about it and experiencing it over and over again.
Doug Bailey, former Boston Globe reporter in Penang, Malaysia. Doug, thank you. Sean Bowen is spokesperson for the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. Sean, tell us, what are the most urgent needs right now in the aftermath of the tsunamis?
Well, first of all, we've got to help people with the very basic requirements that they need, such as shelter, clean drinking water, food, blankets. We'll then be looking at how we're going to help them over the coming weeks with more sturdy shelter, sending in thousands of tents for people to sleep in. And then we'll be looking also at their psychological needs.
And I'm assuming as well that there are health needs that are going to arise. We're hearing about thousands of corpses. What are some of the diseases that you're worried about?
Well, I think the main thing that people will suffer from, which will affect the young and the elderly, is diarrhea because of the bad water. We basically want to get to these people before they become even more vulnerable.
Sean, we're hearing reports of people being rescued by helicopter, sort of picked out of the sea. Is it possible that anyone has survived at this point?
That's difficult to say. I mean, if they've managed to hold on to some wreckage or get above water, then there is a possibility. But I think surviving 24 hours in water would be very, very difficult.
Sean Bowen with the International Red Cross, what are you drawing on? You know, what's the most recent experience at this?
Well, a year ago yesterday, the Red Cross was very involved in the earthquake in Bam, which unfortunately claimed up to 27,000 people. It was a very different sort of earthquake because it was centered on one city, so it was quite a focused response. We were able to get in very quickly.
Bam, of course, was in Iran. Where are the hardest hit places that you're traveling to now?
Sri Lanka is the worst hit. We believe that 12,000 are reported dead. After that, we've got nearly 5,000 dead in Indonesia, 6,000 dead in India.
Sean Bowen is spokesperson for the International Federation of the Red Cross and the Red Crescent Society. She spoke to us from Geneva. Sean, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, here in the U.S., Democrats will pick a new leader next month, replacing outgoing chair of the Democratic National Committee, Terry McAuliffe. Right now, former Vermont Governor Howard Dean has a jump on other candidates, but some Washington insiders are skeptical, and there's a very real possibility that the Democrats could be led by an anti-abortion party chair. Joining us on the line are two veteran Washington watchers. John Harwood is national political editor of The Wall Street Journal. Hi, John.
Hey, Robin.
And Tim Greaves, senior political writer at Salon.com. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Robin.
And I want to start with you first. How much does this post matter? Did people really hang on Terry McAuliffe's every word when he spoke for the party during the national convention? Can they remember his name now?
Well, I think they can remember his name, but can they remember one thing that Terry McAuliffe stood for? I'd suggest the answer is no. I don't know that anybody really thinks of the head of the DNC as taking the party in a political direction that way.
But was Terry McAuliffe at least partially responsible for bringing in all that money, much more than Democrats have at any other time?
Sure. He played a big role in the money side of things, but I think a lot of the focus now in the debate over who should chair the DNC is more in terms of the direction of the party, and I'm just not sure that the chair really has much influence on that point.
Well, in fact, some of the candidates might have some interesting backgrounds that they bring to the fore. John, why don't you start with some of the names that are out there?
Well, you have people like Tim Romer, former House member from Indiana. He recently headed or was a major player in the 9/11 commission, and that is something that would help Democrats sound the message they want to send on national security issues.
Tim Romer also has an interesting issue attached to him. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi is apparently urging him to run because while she is an abortion rights supporter, Tim Romer has a strong record of votes against abortion rights. We're going to talk more in a minute about the issues the party confronts, but abortion is one of them. Can the party afford a leader who is anti-choice?
Well, I think they can afford a leader who's anti-choice. They probably cannot afford a presidential nominee who's anti-choice because so much of the financial and voting base of the party is tied up with a support for abortion rights. But in some respects, as Tim suggested, you know, the role of the DNC chair is circumscribed in a couple of ways. Once you have a presidential candidate, he's the dominant message player in the Democratic Party. You do need a chairman who can help the party reach out to new voters and who can raise the money and run the infrastructure in a way that benefits Democratic candidates. So having a pro-life Democratic chairman would help you respond a little bit to the idea that your party is too narrow, but in the end probably wouldn't repel many voters so long as the nominee of the party in the presidential race supports abortion rights.
And Tim Greaves, we're going to hear in a moment, some in the party are hoping to expand the tent, get a bigger tent on the issue of abortion, be more inclusive on that issue. But before we get to that, some more names, and of course Howard Dean's comes up. Does he have a chance?
Sure, I think he has a chance. I think until Tim Romer surfaced, Howard Dean, and maybe he still is, was really the guy that every DNC member was going to have to make a conscious choice about. Am I going to vote for Howard Dean or am I not? He's the big elephant, which I guess is the wrong metaphor, but he's the big elephant in the room that they're going to have to decide on sort of before I think they get to anyone else on the list because he's so popularly dominant.
But on the other hand, a spokesperson for Republican House Majority Leader Tom DeLay says the only thing better than having Howard Dean as DNC chair is Nancy Pelosi as minority leader. They have their bases covered from San Francisco to Burlington. In other words, you know, expressing the thought that this is too far to the left of the party.
Sure, and you're going to hear that. That's the central debate. Should the Democrats go further to the left? Should they embrace a stronger anti-war position, for example, like Howard Dean did, or should they head in the direction of a Tim Romer, someone who's much more centrist and on some issues fairly conservative? Again, you know, that's what this debate is about. I don't know at the end of the day, as John said, whether that's really going to affect the way the party goes, because it will ultimately be the presidential candidate who does that.
John Harwood, what are some of the other names that are popping out?
Ron Kirk, the former mayor of Dallas, who's an African-American. That would help present a diverse face of the party. But he's also moderate and somebody who had pretty good relations with business in Texas. He was an unsuccessful Senate candidate in 2002. But he's somebody who made a good impression on Democratic Party members in a recent sort of tryout appearance. There's also talk about Harold Ickes. Harold Ickes is a longtime operative from New York. He served in the Clinton White House, and he's somebody who was involved in 2004 in one of these so-called 527 groups outside the party structure that raised large amounts of money from big donors to help turn out voters. And even though they fell short in the election, it is widely believed that that organization did a fairly good job. So Harold Ickes is sort of the inside choice. He's not the most TV-friendly candidate in the world, but he's somebody who certainly knows how to run campaigns.
Yeah, you were referring to MoveOn.org, and we'll talk more about them in a moment. But Tim Grieve, who's been crossed off the list?
Donna Brazile, who was one of Al Gore's people, kind of came and went rather quickly. She says she was never really in. Tom Vilsack came and went quickly, so he's off the list.
Iowa governor, former Iowa governor.
Right, and who was apparently John Kerry's choice, possibly at some point, but he's off the list now. And then there are a few others who are still in. Donnie Fowler, a 37-year-old South Carolinian whose father was the NC chairman, he's in the list. Simon Rosenberg, who's the president of the New Democratic Network, he's in the list. So I mean, there are a whole lot of names, and this doesn't seem to be one of these times when sort of a fix is in and there's one candidate. It seems pretty wide open.
But I do think, Robin, when we get down to the end of the vote, if Howard Dean is still in, you're likely to see the field shrink. And those who don't like Howard Dean, and there are a lot of people who love him and a lot of people who hate him within the party, are likely to coalesce around an alternative to Dean, sort of like they did behind John Kerry in the Democratic primaries this past year.
Well, some, including columnist Joan Vernocchi and the Boston Globe, say whoever it is who's going to lead the Democratic Party over the next several years, it can't be Hillary Clinton. Because she brings the baggage of the memory of the Clinton administration and the issues of moral values that went with that. Your thoughts?
Well, Hillary Clinton is certainly not going to be the party chair, but she could very well be the Democratic nominee in 2008. If you take a poll, she finishes at the top of those potential candidates. And when we in our Wall Street Journal NBC poll just last week asked Democrats, who speaks for you? Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton each took about a quarter of the vote, and everybody else, John Kerry, John Edwards, the Democratic leaders in the House and Senate, had trifling amounts of support compared to Hillary Clinton.
But on the other hand, how about Bill Clinton for Democratic National Chair?
Oh, I think a lot of people in the party would salivate over that. Would he be interested in any universe? I doubt it's a big enough job for him either.
That's Tim Grieve. He's senior political writer at Salon.com. John Harwood is national political editor of The Wall Street Journal. When we return, John and I are going to continue our look into the future of the Democratic Party. What about the Clintons? And what will the party strategy be for the next 4 years? Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Continuing our conversation about the future of the Democratic Party with John Harwood, national political editor of The Wall Street Journal. The 447 members of the Democratic National Committee will meet next month to vote on party chair. And John, you mentioned the liberal advocacy group MoveOn.org. They're demanding a say in the future of the party. They sent out a scathing email saying that Democrats can no longer afford to be led by election losers. Ouch. How much of a say will they have in shaping the party as far as strategy and issues?
Well, anybody who brings a lot of money to the table, as MoveOn.org proved that they did in 2004, is going to have a role. But in the end, Democratic primary voters are the ones who are going to decide. And we've got a long way to go before we figure out who is going to lead.
Several of the chair candidates have said they want to make the Democratic Party a 50-state party again. What do they mean? What's this talk about big tent?
Well, 50-state party is a little bit of hyperbole because there are some states, states like Mississippi and the Deep South the Dakotas or some of the states in the Rocky Mountain West, where Democrats have no chance whatever of competing. But to say a 50-state strategy means you're not going to give up on regions of the country, and Democrats certainly need to do better in the Southwest, where they've got some promising openings with the growth of the Hispanic vote there, and in the South, where they cannot get shut out. That used to be the Democratic's so-called solid South, a real stronghold region. Of course, it's the most conservative region in the country, so it's gone Republican, but they've got to figure out some places to break through there, perhaps Florida, perhaps Virginia, which is adjacent to the Washington, D.C. area, and a lot of the suburban vote that's growing in size in that state leans Democratic.
Well, there's also been a move to perhaps soften or somehow retransmit the party stand on certain issues. Let's go back and talk a little bit more about abortion. There's a move to include more pro-life Democrats or pro-choice Democrats who hate abortion and want abortion as, let's say, a last choice after more education, more prevention. Has the Democratic Party excluded these Democrats, as some are saying, or just not gotten their message out, you know, allowed the Republicans to paint the party as pro-abortion as opposed to pro-choice?
Well, they certainly have to come up with a better message on values issues. Abortion is one of those. But, you know, the American people aren't that far off from where Democrats are on that issue, provided they can cast a message the way Bill Clinton did when he said that abortion should be safe, legal, and rare. In other words, casting it as the opportunity for women to have abortion rather than sort of advocating abortion. That worked for Bill Clinton. There are a lot of Americans who are a bit ambivalent on this subject but reluctant to see those rights taken away. So I don't think that issue itself is an insuperable obstacle to Democrats. They do have a bigger problem with the gay marriage issue, where Republican rhetoric is more in line with public opinion.
What else are you hearing from Democrats that the party has to do to move into the future?
I'm hearing two things in particular. One is the party has to focus more attention on voters outside of central city areas. Democrats do very well in cities and in close-in suburbs. They need to do better in rural and exurban counties, where George W. Bush did very well. And the second thing they need to do is have a candidate who projects some real strength and backbone. One of the things that hurt John Kerry very badly in this campaign was the idea that he was wishy-washy, that he was sort of wimpy, flip-floppy. This is something that that the Bush campaign drove beginning in March when he became the nominee in waiting, and it stuck to him all season long.
Well, Peter Beinart of the New Republic magazine writes that American liberalism has not been fundamentally reshaped by 9/11. Do you agree with that assessment? And are Democrats taking a look at, you know, what they did or didn't do in the last few years?
Well, I think that's an acute observation by Peter. The security issue at the end of the day was the dominant issue in the campaign. George Bush owned that issue mostly because of how he performed on 9/11 and the immediate aftermath of 9/11. But Democrats can do better, and they need to do better. They have to convince Americans that they can keep the American public safe from terrorists, and that was George Bush's ace in the hole, and they've got to match it.
Well, we mentioned the Clintons earlier. The Washington Post asked the question, who do the Clintons want to lead the party? Is there still that sense that the Clintons are anointing the party leaders and the Clintons are sort of, you know, driving the machine of the party from either behind the scenes or right up front?
You know, I think that is an exaggerated notion in the minds of some activists. You remember when Wes Clark entered the Democratic primary race, a lot of people thought he was sort of the cat's paw for Bill and Hillary Clinton. Well, he didn't do very well. And so Bill and Hillary Clinton cannot impose their will on others in the party, although if Hillary Clinton runs and wins primaries herself, she'll get it the old-fashioned way.
Yeah. So we're back at who might lead the party. Your advice for the Democratic Party?
Oh, I think the Democratic Party needs to be needs to figure out who both can be true to their principles, but also show sufficient political skill and breadth to appeal to a wider audience of Americans. The Democratic base is narrower than the Republican base. There are more conservatives in this country than there are liberals, and they need somebody who can reach out and especially do well among moderate voters and in the suburbs. And I suspect you'll see a very competitive race at the end. But the party's likely to pull together because the two political parties we have these days are fairly homogenous ideologically and ready for battle. And this is about picking the general for the next war.
John Harwood, thank you.
You bet.
John is national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. Tomorrow on Here and Now, the man who wants to be the Martin Luther of Islam, a Syrian scholar who's calling for a Protestant-like reformation for Muslims. That's tomorrow. And stay with us. A check on your airline baggage. Where is it? That's coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Thousands of airline travelers were separated from their luggage this weekend, possibly the victims of an unofficial sick-out by U.S. Airways baggage handlers and flight attendants. And this came as a computer glitch at a Delta carrier grounded thousands of passengers. Well, joining us on the line for an airline check-in is George Novak. He's lead research scientist at George Washington University's Aviation Institute. And Mr. Novak, what's your take? Are sick airlines that shouldn't be operational operating?
No, I don't think it's reached that level yet. I mean, U.S. Airways certainly has problems, which are public because of their bankruptcy. And this has created a circumstance where the employees, I think, have felt they have borne the brunt of the damage. And they've certainly given back as many concessions as they feel they can. Now, the union has denied that there was any organized effort, but it was certainly odd that at the height of the travel season, we had this number of sick employees.
In fact, the Washington Post is reporting that some new flight attendants make as little as $12,000 annually. That's less than they would be making if they went to Walmart. And yet some of these unions are being asked to take more cuts, while they say that chief executives at U.S. Airways, for instance, Bruce Lakefield is one, have not taken any pay cuts.
Well, Bruce Lakefield, in fact, did take a pay cut this year, but there's a case to be made, certainly, for these employees, which are getting down to what they view to be barely livable wages just to keep the industry alive.
What is going to happen to the industry, do you think?
The aviation industry is here to stay, but it's going to be an industry which will undergo a number of changes in coming years. I think people look at this and say, is the government doing enough? Is there enough oversight, and are they too unregulated to conduct what is a vital public service? I think this time, of course, during the holidays, tempers are certainly flaring. We will see some type of action, I think, in an inquiry from the Department of Transportation or from Congress as to how this happened and how to prevent it. I don't see at this time a movement towards full re-regulation of the air carriers.
Well, that's the long term. What about the short term? There are people still stranded. What's happening right now?
Well, right now, Comair is trying to resume a full schedule by Wednesday of this week. U.S. Airways is trying to reunite people with their baggage. The U.S. Airways has scheduled at least 8 flights where they are flying baggage only to Charlotte, North Carolina, where they are sorting the issue out, sorting the bags out, and trying to reunite those bags with passengers.
So there are airplanes right now flying around with just luggage, no passengers.
That's my understanding. Yeah.
George Novak is a research scientist at the George Washington University Aviation Institute. George, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The people of Ukraine have spoken again. Yesterday, they voted in the second presidential election in just over a month. With over 98% of the votes in, opposition candidate Viktor Yushchenko is leading with some 53% of the vote, compared to 42% for his opponent, Viktor Yanukovych. Joining us on the line from Kiev is Mike Meyer, Europe editor for Newsweek magazine. And Mike, exactly where are you?
Well, I'm in the middle of Independence Square in the center of Kiev, in a crowd of probably 60,000 people who are beginning to celebrate a revolution. It's hard to tell whether it's a revolution or a carnival, in fact.
Mike, give me more of a sense of what it looks like there. Tell us a little more.
Well, it's an amazing scene. People wearing funny hats, you know, Santa Claus hats, all in orange. Everybody's wearing orange ribbons, the color of this revolution, the orange revolution. There are flags everywhere. There were fireworks the other night. Over on the other side, there are little children having rides on tiny Shetland ponies, you know, about 3 feet high. It's a carnival. It's a celebration. There are balloons everywhere. It's party time.
The Georgian president, who took office a year ago after a similar, you know, velvet revolution, has called and congratulated Yushchenko. Have other world leaders acknowledged what he says is his win?
Well, one person who has not called him is Vladimir Putin. And he campaigned very vigorously against Yushchenko and has been hugely embarrassed. And so there's a lot of silence out of the Kremlin. The Bush administration has said that they'll call and congratulate him after he's inaugurated, which could be next week or it could be in 3 or 4 weeks.
Well,
on the aftermath of this election.
Well, we want to ask you about that. The other candidate, Viktor Yanukovych, the man who won the election last time reportedly through widespread fraud, has he conceded?
Well, people here don't concede. You have to understand that this is one of the last real post-Soviet states in Europe. And these people who are in power don't give it up easily. So Yanukovych is saying, no, we're going to go into opposition, but first we're going to challenge the election in court. It's an empty threat. Yushchenko's margin of victory is far too large. But still, it illustrates the mindset here.
The challenge might be an empty threat, but what about the threat of forming a stiff opposition? Is there a sense that there's trouble ahead, or are most Ukrainians going to unite under Yanukovych?
I actually think they will unite behind Yushchenko.
Mike, there have been a lot of reports here that this homegrown revolution, well, at least a portion of it, was imported. You know, the U.S., for instance, pouring money into it, sending youth groups from the Balkans to help foment it. Yushchenko, I know today, said that this was a Ukrainian vote, and he seemed to be responding to those reports. What are the Ukrainian people saying?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. The people in this square are very much, as Yushchenko said, and you just said, the winners of this revolution. It's their vote. Yes, the United States helped train civil democracy groups, but they gave no money to the opposition directly. They did not give any money to Yushchenko. All of that came from Ukraine and some businessmen who lied with him. Other businessmen allied with Yanukovych gave far greater sums of money. And then there's, of course, the Russians. The Russians gave $300 million to Yanukovych's campaign. It was a massive, massive, massive effort to get this man elected.
Now, Mike, I'm here
to stand right now for the winner. Yushchenko. Listen. It's really pretty dramatic here.
Mike Meyer, I hate to throw a little bit of cold water on it, but is there any possibility that the Ukrainian people might be over-idealizing their candidate? Can anyone really be the man that, you know, they've built him up to be over the past few weeks?
Well, as you say, this isn't black and white. Yushchenko was prime minister. He came out of the system. He's a wealthy man. He's tied to his own oligarchs. That said, however, there's no doubt about his democratic impulse. He wants checks and balances. He wants to create a new constitution, he announced last night, with a genuinely free Supreme Court. All these things that really make for a strong civil society.
Mike Meyer is Europe editor for Newsweek magazine. He's speaking to us from Independence Square in Kiev. Mike, thank you very much.
You're welcome. It's fun.
Well, still to come, is political correctness wiping out political cartooning here in the U.S.? You're listening to Here and Now. Well, here we are in the final week of 2004, a year that's seen the economy continue to expand while job growth and wages trail. Oil prices ballooned, and so did the federal budget and U.S. trade deficits. Martha Stewart went to jail, Google had a spectacular stock offering, and China strengthened its claim as an emerging economic powerhouse. Financial reporter Mark Mills joins us now with a brief wrap of the business year that was. Mark, your overall impressions of the economy in 2004?
Well, Robin, I think it looked like a year that may have been better in the corporate boardroom than it was sitting around the kitchen tables of America. You know, the economy grew nicely, over 4% for the year. Corporate profits surged, double-digit growth in profits. The stock market, the S&P 500, is up about 9%. But job growth was sluggish. We created about 2 million jobs, and 3 million would have felt better. And, of course, we had rising energy costs, health care costs that were cutting into family budgets. So consumer confidence remained a bit skittish.
Right. And people also might feel they're working harder, making less. They've got cuts in benefits as well.
Yeah, I think there's that sense that there's sort of a little bit of a struggle to keep things going in the middle class, a little bit more of a challenge. And I think that could improve if the economy continues to grow and wages grow a bit and it gets a little easier to get a job. But for now, people are still kind of lagging the recovery from the sense of looking at it from the corporate standpoint.
Right. Well, let's take a look at other headlines. The Federal Reserve reversed course in 2004. It had been chopping interest rates. Everybody's refinancing their home loans. But they started raising rates this year, imposing 5/4-point increases in the federal funds rate, which now stands at 2.25. Is that having an impact on the economy?
Well, you know, it's something I think it's more psychological at this point, Robin, than something we're really seeing day to day. When the Fed starts moving interest rates, it's like moving the oil tanker around. It takes a long time to really have an impact, but it has started. And actually, the Fed, by starting to raise rates, shows that it's going to guard against inflation, and that actually has helped the bond market remain confident. And the interest rate on the 10-year U.S. Treasury bond is actually a little bit lower today than it was at the start of the year, even though the short-term rates have been raised by the Fed. So those low rates really helped to keep the housing market strong again through 2004.
Okay, for those who maybe don't have the mortgages to refinance yet. Well, we mentioned the twin deficits, the federal budget deficit, the foreign trade gap. They're causing a lot of worry as 2004 comes to an end. Look ahead.
Yeah, these are kind of big problems that we don't necessarily feel in a dramatic way right away, but they're kind of chipping away at things. The budget deficit, obviously, which was aggravated by the war in Iraq, increases the nation's long-term debt and undermines overseas confidence in the U.S.'s ability to manage itself. The trade deficit also, the other deficit, this is caused partly because the U.S. economy has been stronger than Europe and Japan. And so we're buying more imports than we're able to sell to our trading partners. Mm. But foreign investors have largely been financing both of these deficits. The central banks of China and Japan, for example, buy a lot of U.S. Treasury debt. And so the dollar has continued its decline as people lose a little confidence in the U.S., and it raises the risk that foreign investors may not be interested in buying our debt at the rate they have been, and we might have to raise interest rates to entice those foreigners to come back and keep buying the bonds. And, of course, higher rates are not good for the economy.
Oh, that cycle. Well, the economy isn't about numbers. It's about people. You've got a year-end list of winners and losers. I'm just going to tick through a few in the minute or so we have left. Winners, big winners, the co-founders of Google. They became billionaires when their stock went public. AG Eliot Spitzer in New York, he strengthened his, some say, his bid for the governor there by carrying his crusade against corporate wrongdoings to the insurance industry. But you also list Steve Jobs. Why?
Well, Steve Jobs, a guy who's had his ups and downs over the years, had a great 2004. He, of course, is the co-founder of Apple and Pixar. And the Apple iPod has been a phenomenal success, Robin. As you know, it was a huge seller during the holiday season. And Pixar keeps cranking out those blockbuster animated films like The Incredibles, and they've done very well. Apple stock tripled this year.
Yeah, well, I want to just tick off quick the losers. Of course, many major sports leagues, hockey's got a labor dispute, basketball had that melee, baseball had the steroid scandal, although the Sox won. Michael Eisner barely hung on to his job, had a big public fight with a former friend. Krispy Kreme got hit by the low-carb craze. But Martha Stewart, you have her listed as a loser because she went to jail. I hear she already has a talk show lined up.
Well, she does. I mean, let's face it, if you're convicted of a felony and you go to prison, that's not a good year. But when she gets out of jail, she could be a winner in 2005. She's got a new TV show planned that's going to be developed by the creator of The Survivor show and The Apprentice.
Something to look forward to in 2005. Mark, thanks so much. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. By some estimates, there were more than 200 editorial cartoonists working at staff positions in newspapers around the country back in the early 80s. Well, fast forward to today, and that number has dwindled to 90. J.B. Trosol is a cartoonist who writes about what he calls the evaporating editorial cartoonist in this month's edition of the Nieman Reports, which is published by the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard University. And J.P. joins us from the studios of WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, J.P.
Thanks for having me on.
And I feel as if we should speak to you quickly before you evaporate. I mean, this is true, right? You apparently edited a book that featured the works of cartoonists earlier this year, and yet between the time the book went to press and the time it hit the bookstores, four of those cartoonists, journalists, lost their staff positions.
Yeah, and since I wrote the article, The Evaporating Editorial Cartoonist, two more cartoonists have been bumped from their positions. Well, so it's something of great concern to us.
Well, sure. Why are the jobs disappearing?
It's actually a confluence of things. I mean, there is a great media consolidation going on around the country, and it's been happening for some time. So you have fewer newspapers in fewer towns, whereas before a town may have had, you know, several morning and evening newspapers, each with their own cartoonist, and now you have one paper in each town. Another reason, it's a bean counter mentality. The owners come in and they say, well, we need to cut costs. We need to get our profits up. You know, who can we get rid of? And they look over in the corner and there's the ink-stained wretch drawing funny pictures. And usually he's the first to go.
All right. Well, in fact, you write about Kirk Anderson, who lamented his do you tell me what he sent an email?
Kirk worked for the Pioneer Press for many years up in Minneapolis. At one point, Knight Ritter did some cutbacks, and he was let go, but they still managed to find money to pay for the people who were watering the plants in the president's office. And he said, are plants more important than having a local editorial cartoonist? Again, Kirk is still drawing. He is still producing work for a syndicate and stuff, but he no longer works for a newspaper, no longer has the backing of that staff job.
In fact, the answer to his question was, you know, a resounding yes. The plants are more important because they squashed his final cartoon. But you mentioned that he's still drawing. Are many cartoonists opting for syndication? I mean, you know, you lose the benefits in the full-time staff job, but does that work for a lot of cartoonists?
Well, syndication itself is a thorny issue with cartoonists because some feel that this is part of the problem, and that a lot of newspapers feel it's cheaper to buy the syndication package than actually go out and hire a local cartoonist and have somebody on staff. So it is, some cartoonists feel that is helping the staff positions erode.
Well, then there's John Scherfius. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. He resigned from the St. Louis Dispatch because he said his editor thought he was too critical of President Bush and Republicans in general. Tell us, first of all, what happened in his last cartoon that he would say lends to that theory?
With the situation with John was he had an editor who kept coming in and changing the content of his cartoons around, and he finally thought there was one change too many with that and quit on principle, which is actually rare considering the number of jobs that are out there. A lot of times you get editors coming in who say, you know, tone down the cartoons. We don't want to offend anyone. They don't want to offend local advertisers. They don't want to offend, you know, local members in the community. So you have a real, that's the third thing that's coming in with editors who finally feel that editorial cartoonists are just too much trouble.
What you
to
say,
keep on the staff.
You write that apparently Scherfius did a cartoon about the GOP-controlled House celebrating its passage of a pork barrel-laden appropriations bill that would benefit Republicans, and he had a pig in the picture, and he was told to change the pig into a donkey.
Right, because they wanted the cartoon to be fair and balanced so that it, you know, touched on everyone. So he did that, and then apparently the donkey wasn't happy enough, and so he changed it again and then handed in his resignation because he thought that really with this case it was just too much control, and it was killing his point. These are personal commentaries. This is not like news that is supposed to be fair and balanced. These are just like editorials or anything else where it's taking a position. And for a cartoon to be effective, you can't tinker with it too much and try to make it say be all things to all people or say everything that it needs to say in one cartoon.
On the other hand, there's cartoonist Mike Marland. 2 years ago, he got into trouble with his publisher over a cartoon that he drew. It was a plane with the word Bush budget, and he positioned it flying into two towers, one labeled social, the other security. Of course, the image was reminiscent of 9/11. They got a ton of complaints, and the editor-in-chief of the paper said that the paper was wrong to run it. And it does seem as if it was outside the lines. The White House also singled Marland and the cartoon out. And many people would see that as, you know, going over the line. So is that kind of cartoon a nail in the coffin for all political cartoonists? If people can point to that and say, see, they go over the line.
You will run into situations where a cartoon does not work. Whatever point it's trying to make is lost because the metaphor the cartoonist used wasn't appropriate. Sometimes they're off the mark. The device that they use detracts from the point they're trying to make. And that's something that all cartoons struggle with on a daily basis. You know, you're trying to make a point. You're trying to use imagery. You're trying to use language and metaphor to get your point across. And sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes it backfires. And whatever controversy swells up around the cartoon isn't what the cartoonist intended.
This is also interesting. Do you make it relative for us? Do you think that these are more sensitive times? I'm thinking of old-timey political cartoons, you know, like during the Teapot Dome scandal that were scathing. So are editors more sensitive now? Are there more political pressures? What's your sense?
There are more political pressures, and editors are more sensitive. This is something that we complain about constantly. It comes back to spineless editors, especially now with the Internet and with people's ability to drop an email. Before, you would actually have to work up a real lather to send a letter to the editor. And now very large mailing campaigns can be organized at the drop of a hat. And in addition, you will get them from around the world. It's no longer just 100 angry letters. You might get, in some cases, in some certain situations, editors have received 25,000, 30,000 angry emails. And that's the kind of thing that they eventually feel that maybe the cartoonist is more trouble than it's worth.
Mm. By the way, you mentioned that the New York Times hasn't had a staff cartoonist since 1958. Why?
We'd like to know, too. The most recent example, one of the largest papers in the country, the Chicago Tribune, after Jeff McNally died in 2000, they have still, almost five years later, have yet to replace him. But with the New York Times, it's been, almost 50 years since they've had a cartoonist? And we'd like to know why. I mean, we don't see this as just a job opening that goes unfulfilled. We think this is a symptom of a larger problem.
Okay, that's one more phone call we have to put on our to-do list. But in the meantime, what would you tell the New York Times? Why should they?
The surveys show that readers of newspapers, they want local content. They want stuff that's visual. They want stuff that's going to engage them. And editorial cartoons, especially if you have a local staff cartoonist, fits that bill. So why aren't more newspapers having one of us on the staff?
J.P. Trosel is a cartoonist whose work is featured in the Herald Sun in Durham, North Carolina, as well as the Chapel Hill Herald. He's also editor of Attack of the Political Cartoonists, Insights and Assaults from Today's Editorial Pages. For more on that, go to our website, here-now.org. But by the way, we did call the New York Times to find out why the paper doesn't have a staff cartoonist. A spokesperson said it's just a long tradition, and the paper does publish a weekly roundup of cartoons from different papers every Sunday. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.